Iran's leader tells the visiting Sultan of Oman that regional countries should beware of the Israeli regime's divisive policies. No end in sight to the Israeli violence in the West Bank. Regime forces kill more Palestinians in the occupied territories. And Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez calls for a snap election a day after his Socialist Party suffers defeat in local and regional polls. Welcome to World News, coming to you out of our headquarters right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to Iran this hour, where the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says all-out expansion of ties with Oman will benefit both countries. Ayatollah Khamenei says Tehran and Muscat should continue their negotiations with seriousness to get tangible results that lead to expanded relations. The leader made the comment in a meeting with the visiting Sultan of Oman, Haitham bin Tariq. Ayatollah Khamenei also underlined the significance of increased cooperation between Iran and Oman, seeing how they share what he called the very important Strait of Hormuz. Well, the leader also warned about the risk posed by Israel in the region, saying the regime and its supporters seek discord among regional countries. Ayatollah Khamenei also hailed the Iranian government's efforts to improve relations with regional countries, including Saudi Arabia. He noted that Iran is also open to the restoration of ties with Egypt. Earlier during the meeting, the Sultan of Oman said Egypt was willing to restore diplomatic ties with Iran. He also said Muscat seeks closer cooperation with neighboring countries, especially Iran.
Tehran is once again the destination of yet another high-profile visit by head of state of one of Iran's leading neighbors. The Sultan of Oman, Haitham bin Tariq Al Said, leading a high-ranking delegation, arrived in the Iranian capital on Sunday. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi officially welcomed the Omani leader. The two leaders then held private discussions and signed cooperation documents in a number of fields, including economy, investment, and energy. Prior to his meeting with the Iranian president, the Omani Sultan held a meeting with Iran's vice president, Mohammad Mukhbir. Referring to close political ties between Iran and Oman, Mukhbir said the two countries should increase their economic and trade ties to a level that could match their political relations. Sultan Haitham Al Said's entourage to Tehran includes Omani Foreign Minister Sayyid Baz bin Hamad Al Busaidi, who met with his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdollahian. Following their meeting, the two officials held a joint press conference where they briefed reporters on the agreements reached by the two sides.
The documents, which focus on cooperation in the fields of energy, investment, free zones, as well as in the areas of industry.
Iran's foreign minister added that other issues were also discussed by the two leaders, namely the transit of goods, the Ashgabat Agreement, as well as quadrilateral transit deal between Iran, Oman, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. He said closer cooperation among regional countries was also emphasized during negotiations between the two leaders. The Omani foreign minister, for his part, noted that the two sides reached good agreements in a bid to further enhance their age-old relations.
Well, the Omani Sultan's visit of Iran comes as Muscat has for many years played a leading role in putting an end to hostility, both on a regional and international levels. Now, with Oman's mediation efforts to end such hostility on one side and regional determination to boost diplomatic relations on the other, it seems that countries in the West Asia region are becoming integrated in the face of the unilateral world.
The visit by Sultan of Oman Haitham bin Tariq Al Said to Iran comes at the official invitation of President Ebrahim Raisi. The invitation was extended as part of President Raisi's policy of deepening ties with countries in the region. The two-day trip marks a significant milestone in ties between the two regional allies. Officials from both countries have said the trip will open new avenues for closer diplomatic cooperation, increased dialogue, and engagement at the highest levels. As far as the economic potential between the two countries is concerned, Iran and Oman are seeking better opportunities to develop their relations. Chairman of the Iranian side in the Omani-Iranian Joint Business Council, Jamal Razzaghi, says Iran aspires for increasing the size of the exchange of trade with Oman to $5 billion. This is possible as there are great opportunities for trade between the two countries. Iran does not view Oman as an economic market, but as a vital strategic partner. The improvement of trade relations has the potential to expand to other areas as well. Iran's ambassador to Oman, Ali Najafi Khoshroudi, says Sultan Haytham al-Said's visit to Tehran will foster an unprecedented level of partnership and cooperation between the two nations. Apart from the economic aspect of the trip, the Omani Sultan's visit to the Islamic Republic is of high significance for the development of multilateral diplomatic relations and a strengthening of regional integration. Prior to his Iran trip, Sultan Haytham al-Said paid an official visit to Egypt, where Egyptian officials were cited as saying that Cairo and Tehran are expected to normalize ties as part of a process mediated by Oman. Regarding the Saudi Arabia-Iran deal, it was Oman that mediated negotiations for 2 years. Oman has also been the chief architect of normalization of relations between Syria and the Arab League. Mediating talks between Saudi Arabia and Yemen's Ansar Allah movement was also another turning point in the history of the Persian Gulf Arab state. In a broader aspect, Oman has for decades been an interlocutor in interactions between Tehran and the West. The country has mediated the release of several foreign citizens and dual nationals. Now with Muscat and Tehran trying to deepen their relations in numerous fields, including political and economic, it seems that regional and international developments are moving toward a multipolar world, something that the collective West has left no stone unturned not to let that happen.
Well said, Mohammed Marandi is a university professor and political analyst. He puts into context the Omani Sultan's visit to Iran.
Iranian-Omani relations have always been good, and cooperation has always existed at very different levels, both political and economic ties. And Oman wants to become a hub for business as well, and Iran is an ideal partner. But I think after the rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia and the changes that are taking place across West Asia and the Persian Gulf, the Saudis rethinking their ties with Syria, negotiating with Yemen, and the potential for the formation of a government in Lebanon, along with other changes that we see between countries in the Persian Gulf region, small countries that have been under the sway of Saudi Arabia. These changes together, I think, potentially bring about a new era for our region. And Oman, having this very good relationship with Iran, stands to benefit a lot from these changes.
Iran says a recent security agreement it signed with Iraq facilitates cooperation in all fields. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Akbar Ahmadiyan, made the announcement during a meeting with his Iraqi counterpart in Tehran. He called the agreement a roadmap for establishing security at the borders, stressing the need for the precise implementation of its stipulations. Tehran expects Baghdad to guarantee border security based on the agreement and to put an end to the presence of anti-Iran elements on Iraqi soil. For his part, Qasem al-Urouji stressed that Iraq's commitment to the recent agreement and said the Iraqi government and its national security body is determined to interact with Iran in all fields. Two Palestinians succumbed to injuries after being shot by Israeli forces in raids in the occupied West Bank. One of the Palestinians lost his life after he was critically injured in an incursion in the city of Jenin. The raid triggered confrontation with locals where 7 others were also wounded. The other Palestinian succumbed to his injuries sustained in an Israeli raid in Al-Khalil 2 days earlier. Earlier today, regime forces also carried out a separate raid in a village near Ramallah. They shot and injured 2 more Palestinians there. Now, the regime has intensified its crackdown across the occupied territories in recent months. Nearly 150 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks in the West Bank alone. this year. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, to give us more details about the latest Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank.
After the incursion to Jenin has ended, the 37-year-old Palestinian Ashraf Ibrahim succumbed to his injury. Palestinian paramedics say that Ashraf Ibrahim was shot in the abdomen and the chest. Then he succumbed to his injuries. Ashraf Ibrahim, 37-year-old from Jenin, was an officer in the Palestinian Security Forces, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. During the operation, six other Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military issued a statement saying that has been under fire with Palestinian fighters. Hurled explosive devices towards the Israeli forces in raiding Jenin City, and that the Israeli troops had confiscated a number of Palestinian arms and weapons, as well as other military equipment in the city of Jenin. Israeli military also said that six other Palestinians had been arrested in other areas of the occupied West Bank, and they claimed that those who were detained, not in Jenin, in other areas of the occupied West Bank, are involved in anti-Israeli operations, that they had took part in shooting towards Israeli settlers and Israeli forces.
Well, the Spanish Prime Minister has called for snap election after his Socialist Party lost regional and local polls to the opposition Popular Party. Pedro Sanchez said in a televised message that his decision was to dissolve parliament and call for general election on July the 23rd. He says the Spanish people need to clarify their demands. With 31% of the votes, the right-wing Popular Party has made significant gains in six regions that had been under the ruling Socialist Party's control. Well, the date is set for late July, 5 months ahead of the original election that was due to be held. The Russian Defense Ministry spokesman says his country's forces have hit Ukrainian air bases, destroying all their targets.
Tonight, Russian military carried out a group strike on the enemy's airfields with high-precision long-range air missiles. The aim of the strike was reached. All assigned objects were destroyed. As a result of the strike, battle headquarters and radar stations were hit, as well as aviation equipment and ammo and weapons depots.
The attacks have been part of a new wave of Russian airstrikes. Ukraine says it has downed all the Russian missiles fired on the country in a second wave of attacks on Monday. The air raids followed hours after overnight missile and drone strikes and was the 16th on Kiev this month. Ukraine has recently been armed with more Western weapons. The Ukrainian military says an attack on Odessa port has caused a fire and damaged infrastructure. Moscow has intensified missile and drone strikes on Kiev this month after a lull of nearly 2 months targeting military facilities and supplies. Russia has repeatedly warned the West against providing Kiev with more advanced weapons, including F-16 fighter jets. Now to Turkey, where President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wins re-election in Sunday's runoff vote, extending his rule into the third decade. With over 99% of ballot boxes open, Erdogan garnered more than 52% of the votes. His rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, received nearly 48%, trailing Erdogan by more than 2 million votes. Now, the country's Supreme Election Council says the uncounted ballots will not change the results. After he was declared the winner, Erdogan addressed a crowd of his supporters outside of the presidential palace in the capital, Ankara. He called on Turks to unite in favor of the country's national goals.
It's time to unite and unify around our national goals and national dreams, leaving aside all discussions and disputes regarding the election period.
Erdogan also says the election is Turkey's most important in the modern era, adding that the entire nation is the winner. Opposition leader Kılıçdaroğlu has not explicitly conceded defeat. He says the election was the most unfair in recent years, and Erdogan's party mobilized all the means of the state against him. However, he thanked people who voted for him. Roshan Saklem earlier told us about the general mood in Turkey after the runoff election in the country.
So 25 million Turkish citizens are not happy about the result. However, they still respect democracy and they still respect the constitution in Turkey and say that Erdogan had won fair and square. So if you look at the areas dominated by opposition, like, for example, I am now in an area, or I actually live in an area that is mainly an opposition area. Yesterday, when we started having the results, all the shops, all the cafes, all the restaurants were closed. No one was in the streets. Only the police was roaming the streets of this district. Also, I have to mention that there is a huge districts that are dominated by refugees, migrants, Arab citizens, Syrians, Egyptians in Istanbul, who were in the streets celebrating. Like, I literally went to one of those districts and I couldn't see one Turkish citizen celebrating. All of the people in the streets celebrating were foreigners. And this has to do with the opposition promising to send all migrants back to their homes, and President Erdogan defending their presence and saying that we have created a safe haven for them and we are not going to let them down.
U.S. President Joe Biden says a deal with Republicans to raise the country's debt ceiling is finalized and is ready to move to Congress for a vote. Biden has urged lawmakers to pass the deal to take the threat of default off the table and to protect America's hard-earned economic recovery. U.S. national debt currently stands at around $31.5 trillion. A yes vote would suspend the debt until January of 2025. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has predicted that he would have the support of the majority of his fellow Republicans. Well, the deal comes after weeks of heated debate, as Republicans wanted to wanted spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed upon first. The legislation needs to pass before June the 5th, when the U.S. Treasury says it would run short of money to cover all of its obligations. And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
A new survey has found that energy rationing has harmed Britain's health. According to this research, poor families used extreme heating methods that compromised their well-being and safety. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to the UK government's advisory body committee on fuel poverty, Amid soaring energy prices and growing fuel poverty, UK households rationed heat this past winter, which resulted in 57% of those rationing heat suffering from deteriorating health and well-being. Last winter, energy use was massively rationed across the UK. According to Citizens' Advice, in 2022, the number of people unable to top up their repayment meter was more than the previous 10 years combined. The committee, sponsored by the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, said, as a result, alternative heating strategies such as the use of electric blankets and hot water bottles spiked in popularity. The committee said in their research, which was conducted by London Economics Limited, the cost of living crisis and concurrent increases in energy costs has led to a substantial increase in the number of households in areas on energy bills, both in gas and electricity. So many people resorted to rationing energy in the UK, and 57% of those rationing fuel, equal to 34% of all adults in the UK, saw negative health and well-being consequences. For older people, 800,000 of over 60s left their homes in January 2023 to stay warm elsewhere. The research showed of consumers who used less electricity and gas in the winter of 2022 to 2023, who were 60% of adults, 43% were using a tumble dryer less often, and 42% were using washing machine less often, the research found. To alleviate the effects of the cost of living crisis, some fuel-poor households have resorted to more extreme coping strategies to ration their energy use, compromising their health, well-being, and in some cases safety, the committee said in the report. Many households in other countries also struggled to cope with the energy crisis. Just ahead of 2022 to 2023 winter, Germany's insurance industry warned consumers against dangerous experiments to heat amid soaring energy prices. The insurers are concerned that the risk of fire is rising with the use of candles, too many electric heaters, or makeshift fireplaces. Meanwhile, RT reported growing fuel poverty amid surging energy prices forced many households in the UK to resort to energy rationing over the winter, compromising their health and well-being, the government-sponsored Committee on Fuel Poverty said in its report published recently. According to the study, many households could not afford to heat their homes sufficiently in winter, which led to massive rationing across the UK. To stay warm and save energy, people used improvised fuels such as clothes, books, and waste, as well as alternative means of light such as candles, the report revealed. The number of people unable to top up their repayment meters in 2022 was higher than in the previous 10 years combined, as some fuel-poor families self-disconnected, letting energy meters run out, according to the research. The report said the cost of living crisis and concurrent increases in energy costs has led to a substantial increase in the number of households in areas on energy bills, both in gas and electricity. The study added some fuel poor households have resorted to more extreme coping strategies to ration their energy use, compromising their health, well-being, and in some cases, safety. As a result, 57% of adults who reported having used less fuel felt that having no cutback on heating their home affected their health and well-being, researchers wrote. The report also found out that about 800,000 elderly people across the UK left their homes in January 2023 to stay warm elsewhere. Some 60% of adults used less electricity and gas over the past winter, with 43% of those surveyed cutting down on the use of a tumble dryer and 42% using their washing machines less often, the research found.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
And so how do we increase our light in our hearts? This is what an important part of the discussion is, or the second half of today's discussion is, that how do we increase this light? This light is increased by two factors, very easy factors, right? It's by faith, increasing our iman, but then ensuring that the actions that we produce are in sync with that iman, right? The more our actions are in sync with our iman, the more light it produces, right? And so when I know not to lie and I don't lie, more light is created, right? I know, for example, this is haram and I don't do it, light is created. But on the flip side, if I know I shouldn't watch this thing, but I still end up watching it, it extinguishes light, right? Like in this world, there's no effect necessarily. But in the spiritual world, the effect that is taking place is it's extinguishing light. And what we have to be careful about is that we may get to a point where all light is extinguished. And at that point, I am in trouble, right? And so one of the ways, as we said, so what we have to work on is ensuring that we have the qualities of a believer. And we act on those qualities of a believer on a consistent basis, so that it produces this light. And this is what brings us to this very beautiful hadith. Again, from our 8th Imam, Ar-Ridha alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam. Salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Where he says, La yakunul mu'min mu'minan. So right away, this is a very important hadith, right? He says that a believer can't be considered a believer. Hatta yakuna fihi thalathu khisalin. Unless there are three qualities found in this believer, right? So we, to translate this to what we're talking about today, the light is created by having these qualities, right? And it's not just about having these qualities, it's about having these qualities on a consistent basis to where it's not difficult for me to produce these qualities. You understand? Right? I can produce a quality of goodness, but if I don't produce that quality of goodness naturally, it hasn't become a characteristic yet. Right? And so until it becomes naturally producing, that's when I've succeeded. But the way to get there is through repetition. That's it. You only repeat good acts over and over and over again until it becomes our tabia, until it becomes our nature that we have these good acts. So what are these three things, these three qualities that the Imam talks about? He says first, sunnatun min rabbihi, a tradition or a quality from his Lord. Wa sunnatun min nabihi, and a sunnah or a tradition or a quality from the Prophet. Wa sunnatun min waliyihi. Yeah? and a tradition from his wali. So we need to have three qualities: one that God has, one that the Prophet has, and one that the Imams have. What is the first quality? We'll say all of these and then we will explain each one inshallah. He says, فَأَمَّا السُنَّةُ مِنْ رَبِّهِ فَكِتْمَانُ السِّرِّ. Yeah? As far as the quality from his Lord, it is to conceal or guard one's secrets. Yeah? Number two, وَأَمَّا السُنَّةُ مِنْ نَبِيِّهِ فَمُدَارَاتُ النَّاسِ. And the quality from the Prophet is to be good-natured with people. Yeah? And the quality from his wali, وَأَمَّا السُنَّةُ مِنْ وَلِيِّهِ فَالصَّبْرُ فِي الْبَأْسَاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ. To have sabr, patience in times of distress and in times of affliction. Allah mentions these two forms, بَأْسَاءُ وَالضَّرَّاءِ. Let's look at each one of these, because I think that we can practically take something very simple from this. You know, like these discussions that we have are not, shouldn't be complicated. They should be very simple to apply into our lives. Now, whether or not we have the courage to apply them is something else, right? He says the first quality is the quality of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that is to conceal and guard secrets. Kitmanu sir, right? There are two ways of understanding this, right? The first way of understanding this is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala naturally is the knower of the unseen. Allah knows everything, right? But He doesn't share that knowledge with everyone, right? He doesn't. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Al-Jinn, the verse that I read in the khutbah, verses 26 and 27, He says, "Alimul Ghayb," that Allah is the knower of the unseen. Alimul Ghayb. فَلَا يُظْهِرُ عَلَىٰ غَيْبِهِ أَحَدًا. And that He does not disclose His knowledge to anyone. Yeah? Allah is the knower of the unseen. He does not disclose His knowledge to anyone. إِلَّا مَنِ ارْتَضَى مِنْ رَسُولٍ. Yeah? Except for the one whom He has approved as His messengers. Right? That means there are certain people who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala discloses the truth to. Even the disclosure of God of this truth is at times partial, yeah, and never entirely, right? So for example, partial knowledge, Allah for example told Nabi Musa, come to me for 30 days. Musa came for 30 days, and then Allah extended it for 10 more, made it 40. Allah always knew He wanted Musa for 40 days. But he gave Musa partial knowledge, alayhi salam. Why? Because that would have an effect on how the people reacted when he left them for another 10 days, right? And so he sometimes gives this partial knowledge to prophets, and he shares this knowledge with whomever he desires. So that's God. Yeah, God is kitmanu sir, right? He hides his secrets. He has secrets. He doesn't reveal His knowledge to everyone. This brings about two points that we can practically apply into our lives. Number one, we all have secrets. Yeah? We all have worries. We all have needs. We don't need to tell them to anyone. Yeah? Except for those who are closest to us. Except for those who are closest to us. Not everyone needs to know my faqr, my poverty. Yeah? Not everyone needs to know my troubles. Not everyone needs to know my hardships. Keep it between you and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the ones who are closest to you. Like your spouse, your parents maybe, your children maybe. Right? But besides that, it's not knowledge that others need to have about me. I think sometimes in the translation of this, right? What we begin to display in our communication about our difficulties to others is that we are displaying that we are not satisfied with God's lot for us. Like, I wish it was different. And I'm expecting you to change it when Allah has put me in this situation. Right? And so this is an important point for us to keep in mind. Don't share everything with everyone. Keep it private. It's important that we keep it private. And another extension of that is that, look, we all have baggage. Okay? We all have a past, we all have history, we all have sins that we're not proud of. You don't need to share that with anyone. Yeah? Don't ever share that with anyone. Like, I know psychologically it feels good to share one's burdens. This is why counselors and psychologists and psychiatrists exist, right? Because it helps. There's no doubt that it helps, right? Illa man irtada, except for those who are close to you, who can help you, right? In Islam, you know, we don't have a confessional system. Right? We don't have a system where you come to me and say, Shaykh, this is my sin.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Nakba is not merely a past event. It is an ongoing reality Palestinians live where every day brings more killings, closures, detentions, home demolitions, racial discrimination, humiliation, and segregation by the Zionist regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, "In the Palestinian memory, the month of May will always be associated with the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of the native Palestinian population from their homes and lands in 1947-49 was foundational to the creation of the fabricated regime of Israel. It was only with the forced expulsion of 750,000 to 1 million Palestinians, as well as the killing of thousands of others, many in tens of masses across Palestine, that the emerging Zionist regime could secure a Jewish majority. But clearly, the colonial regime is not yet feeling either satisfied or safe. On the contrary, this month, May 2023, 75 years after the Nakba, Palestine has endured a series of new Israeli regime assaults. On May 2nd, the Palestinian prisoner Khaz Adnan died in an Israeli regime jail after nearly 3 months of hunger strike. He embarked on hunger strike in protest at his administrative detention. Detention without charge or trial. Adnan spent 8 years on and off in Israeli regime prison, mostly in administrative detention. His death could not have been an accident. The Zionist regime was aware that he needed urgent health care, yet none was proffered and was not transferred to hospital. He was allowed to die on purpose in order to deter other prisoners from engaging in similar hunger strikes. His death triggered a major Israeli regime assault, which started on May 9th, when Israeli regime warplanes struck a number of residential buildings in Gaza where families were sleeping. The first strikes killed 12 and injured 20. Among the victims were three Islamic Jihad fighters, along with their wives and children. That first assault was followed by several others over 5 days. At least 33 Palestinians were killed, the majority civilians, including 7 children. The fabricated regime of Israel has killed some 140 Palestinians in both the West Bank and Gaza since the beginning of 2023. Since the 1948 Nakba, the Zionist regime has killed over 100,000 Palestinians and destroyed at least 130,000 homes and other structures. Since the occupation of the rest of historic Palestine in 1967, the Zionist regime has imprisoned more than a million Palestinians, while still depriving Palestinian refugees from returning to their homes and villages. And in recent years, May has become the killing month. In 2021, an Israeli regime assault on Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque led to a broad confrontation with Palestinians across Palestine, resulting in the killing of 256 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children and 40 women. Last May, an Israeli sniper killed renowned Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh while she was working in Jenin. A few days later, Israeli regime police attacked her funeral in Al-Quds. Such wanton violence suggests that the Zionist regime's ethnic cleansing project has not finished. A regime based on aggression and the systematic terrorizing of Palestine's native population will not rest easy until the project started in 1948 is complete. But in 75 years, the Zionist regime has not yet succeeded to back up its foundational lie that Palestine was a land with no people. By obliterating the Palestinian people, their memory, their history, or their refusal to give up. In other words, the Zionist regime is fearful and agitated. It lives in constant obsession with being surrounded by danger. In light of such logic, the existence of Palestinians in Palestine alone is incendiary to the colonial regime of Israel. After the latest Israeli regime aggression on Gaza, which saw at least 6 Islamic Jihad leaders assassinated, the Zionist regime projected arrogance. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Zionist regime's prime minister, declared that Israel's assault had changed the balance of deterrence and proudly announced that Israel's flag march and annual right-wing nationalist assertion of sovereignty over occupied Al-Quds would proceed as planned. Stable and sane countries do not feel the need to prove sovereignty over cities they claim as capitals. It is a symbol of deep-seated malaise that the Zionist regime considers it a glorious victory after 56 years of occupation to organize a march for settlers to wave flags in Al-Quds. The flag march is a victory only in the way the Israeli regime's military ability to kill and detain Palestinians or encage them in checkpoints is a victory. It is made possible only through overwhelming force and the continued support of Western regimes. The hollow victory is not a defeat for Palestinians who continue to struggle and resist to preserve their existence despite the tremendous suffering and military violence they have to confront. The Zionist regime cannot give up its inherently violent colonial nature precisely because it was established by uprooting a people from their homeland. The continued presence of Palestinians on part of their land directly contradicts the Zionist narrative of how the fabricated regime of Israel emerged. The fabricated regime of Israel is still in denial and believes the only way for it to continue to exist is through the ethnic cleansing and cancellation of Palestine's indigenous people. Every new Israeli crime maximizes Palestinian suffering, but it also demonstrates that far from being confident and at ease with itself, the Zionist regime is a regime of fear and insecurity. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported recently the Israeli occupation authorities demolished, confiscated, or forced people to demolish 42 structures in East Al-Quds and Area C of the West Bank, including 17 homes, citing the lack of Israeli-issued building permits, which are almost impossible to obtain, displacing 50 Palestinians, including 23 children, and affecting the livelihoods of more than 600 others, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, in the occupied Palestinian territory. It said in its bi-weekly Protection of Civilians report covering the first 2 weeks of May that 9 of the structures were provided by donors as humanitarian assistance, including a school. More than half of the affected structures were in Area C, which is under full Israeli regime military control, including a donor-funded school. The remaining 16 structures were demolished in occupied East Al-Quds, including 2 residential structures demolished in Wadi Qaddoum area of Silwan, resulting in the displacement of 7 households comprising 39 people, including 22 children. Another 7 structures were destroyed by their owners to avoid the payment of fines to the Zionist regime authorities. Additionally, in Area A of the West Bank, under full Palestinian rule, Israeli regime forces destroyed 1 residential structure and caused damage to 3 others during an Israeli regime operation carried out in the old city of Nablus. On May 7th, Israeli regime forces demolished an EU-funded Palestinian school serving at least 40 pupils from Jebel al-Deeb near Beit Lahm, citing the lack of an Israeli-issued building permit and structural safety concerns. 57 schools across the West Bank are at risk of demolition, said OCHA. In a separate incident on May 10th, the Israeli civil administration, along with Israeli regime forces, dismantled and confiscated 2 tents that were used as temporary classrooms for the pupils of the school of Jebel al-Deeb. The tents were provided as humanitarian assistance in response to the demolition on May 7th. During the confiscation, confrontations erupted between Palestinian residents and the Zionist regime forces. As a result, 8 Palestinians were injured. School equipment, including chairs and desks, were confiscated by Israeli regime forces. On May 2nd and 3rd, Israeli regime forces raided the villages of Hajjah in Galgilia Governorate and Haris in Salfit Governorate in Area B of the West Bank, which is under Palestinian administration and the Zionist regime military control, and demolished on punitive grounds two multiple-story homes of families. Three households comprising 14 people, including 8 children, were displaced. 9 others, including 3 children, were otherwise affected. Since the beginning of 2023, 10 homes and 1 agricultural-related structure have been demolished by the Zionist regime forces on punitive grounds, compared with 14 structures in all of 2022 and 3 in 2021. Punitive demolitions are a form of collective punishment and as such are illegal under international law as they target the families of a perpetrator or alleged perpetrator, said OCHA. In addition to the demolitions, the OCHA report said that from the beginning of 2023 until May 15th, the Zionist regime forces killed 108 Palestinians in the West Bank, including Istal Quds, more than double the death toll of 51 in the same period in 2022, and 12 other Palestinians have been shot and killed by Israeli regime forces while attacking or trying to attack forces in the West Bank.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023.
I will keep thinking and worrying about idealism if there is no hope. And rationality is the steering wheel for this engine. You must think rationally, act wisely, and move forward. As for universities, I have much to say about them. You also spoke about them, and what you said is correct. The problems you mentioned exist. What I want to say is that the lack of a truly comprehensive scientific plan is a great shortcoming in our universities today. We don't know what basis is used for the distribution of students in various scientific fields of study. These scientific courses of study should be in fields that are needed in the country. They must benefit the country. How many students do we need in a certain field? These matters should be considered, and work needs to be done on this. I'd like to ask the Honorable Minister of Science, he's probably among us here, to pursue this matter. It is one of the important tasks that you need to do.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are some fields of study that aren't even needed in Iran. There aren't any jobs in these fields either. Well, what's the point? There is no point in carrying out certain academic activities or attending certain academic courses. Perhaps we have several hundreds of thousands of high school graduates who are able to work in different sectors right now. But instead, we bring them into the university environment, and after a while, we turn over a few hundred thousands angry, demanding, unemployed people with a bachelor's or master's degree to the country. Let's think about what we need and take action according to our needs. If we have a university graduate who doesn't have a job, you should know that there is a problem with our educational system. If someone studies a field of study in order to be able to benefit his or her country, their job must be ready. If we have a graduate, but he does not have a job, it is clear that this student's enrollment was not done systematically based on correct calculations. Well, our time is up and there is still much to be said. I like you and I pray for you. May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.